Hi, I'm Riley Fessler. I'm a podcast producer here at the DSR Network, which means that my job is to make sure that we have great content and great guests across all of our shows. Our programming is supported by our members, and for that, we are truly grateful. I hope that you'll consider becoming a member to support the work that we do. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack and Discord communities. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support.
Nine. 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is the DSR Mothership, the main podcast of our week out of the many, many podcasts we do. I'm David Rothkopf, your host, as I have been for, about a decade. And we're going to do something special today, kind of different from what we've done over the course of that decade, because since our goal is to provide perspectives on important stories around the world that have to do with foreign policy and national security, we try to cast our net a little bit wider than just the usual suspects who are foreign policy experts or politicians or military experts, and really would like to do more to give a sense of the situation on the ground in the countries that we are paying attention to. And I can think of nobody who's in a better position to provide just that kind of perspective than our guest, my friend Nate Mook, who is the special advisor on Ukraine for the Conflict and Development Foundation and member of the Hachiko Foundation, which helps place displaced animals on the front line of Ukraine. And Nate also previously served as the CEO of World Central Kitchen, one of the great humanitarian enterprises of our lifetime, a really remarkable achievement. Of course, Nate, when I met you, you hadn't done any of those things. You've been busy.
Yeah, I was a different life. I was making documentary films back then for HBO, working in the tech industry for a while previously. And and then sort of found myself in the nonprofit world and ended up building World Central Kitchen with Jose for many, many years. And that's what took me into Ukraine.
Did you have any idea when you started that with Jose what it would become? I mean, because it's, I mean, like, the, you're like, they call you guys first, or I mean, you were the CEO, but they call World Central Kitchen first whenever there's a problem. They call before the UN at this
point. Yeah, you know, in some ways, we actually sometimes end up on the ground and end up calling the people instead of them calling us because we're often there in advance. But when I first met Jose, the thing that really struck me, and for anybody that's ever met Chef Jose Andres, he has probably the most energy out of anybody I have ever met. This is something that Anthony Bourdain has said as well, that Jose just has this energy and passion to him. And so when I met him in the earliest of days, he was just sort of thinking about the type of work that chefs, the type of humanitarian work that chefs could be involved in after the big earthquake in Haiti in 2010, he had this passion and this, you could see there was almost like a twinkle in his eye that he was trying to figure things out. And so certainly at the time, I had no idea potentially what we were about to embark upon in terms of building an organization that reached $500 million a year. But I knew there was something special there.
How many places is it operating now?
Oh, wow. Well, I was just talking to my former team recently because they're doing a lot of work in supporting Gaza right now. They're continuing to do work in Ukraine. And I see a lot of my former team and former Ukrainian team that I worked with from the beginning of the full-scale invasion. And I think those are the two big places that World Central Kitchen is operating now. And then, of course, you know, we always were responsive to anything that was going on in the world, the big disasters, but often some smaller disasters too. And we really prided ourselves for being, you know, first on the ground. But of course, Ukraine was such a dramatic inflection point for the organization.
So tell me a little bit about that. Tell me about your going into Ukraine, focusing on that, and the path that has taken you to where you are.
Yeah. So, you know, Jose and I ended up down in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria in 2017. And this was a moment where we developed the model to feed people fresh, healthy, nutritious meals at scale after these big disasters. Because the traditional model was sort of either people fending for themselves or governments would try to bring in what we call meals ready to eat, which are, you know, the types of packaged things we give to our military in conflict areas, or other types of supplies that would take a really long time to bring in. And our model was what we thought was very simple, but it turned out was quite innovative, which was, you know, activating the local resources on the ground. So instead of, for example, shipping in a bunch of bread from Miami to Puerto Rico, well, how about we just make sure the bakeries that are already in Puerto Rico have the fuel for their generators so they can bake their own bread? And it was this type of thinking of activating the local resources, the local people, the local knowledge that enabled us to move so quickly and scale up these types of humanitarian food responses, starting in Puerto Rico, but very quickly all over the world, from wildfires in California to volcanoes in Guatemala to earthquakes in Indonesia, et cetera, et cetera. Ukraine was a bit of a different beast because it was an active war zone. And when we first got to the region, the original plan was actually to support the refugees, the Ukrainian refugees that were coming out of Ukraine into Poland. And there were tens of thousands of them crossing the border every day into Poland and other neighboring countries. Millions of Ukrainians have fled the country. I think the pre-war population was about 40 million. Now the estimates are around 25 million. So a massive displacement of the Ukrainian population because of the invasion, the full-scale invasion by Russia. So originally, we actually planned to get to the border with Poland and see if we were even needed to help the refugees. You know, I assumed that with such a major incursion into Europe, I mean, in some ways, kind of the biggest confrontation since World War II, that you'd see an immediate response of the UN, the EU. And what we found when we arrived onto the border, the Polish-Ukrainian border, was really there was no support. There were some volunteer groups helping out. So it was very clear right away that we needed to activate a response. And so we did that with our traditional model, which is what can we activate quickly from local providers, local resources, and then build up our own capacity to be able to support longer term. So get kitchens up and running. And we had a 24-hour operation working all across all of the border crossings from Ukraine into neighboring countries. And then from there, really almost immediately, we sort of started to look at what we could do to get a response in Ukraine up and running. And I crossed into Ukraine the first time February 27th, so just 3 days after the full-scale invasion began in 2022. It was about negative 15 degrees outside, and there were, you know, dozens of miles of cars that were trying to get across. And the first step was try to support those families that were trying to get out of Ukraine. And then very quickly, we sought to activate restaurants and other service providers within Ukraine and build capacity in the country to support those families that were displaced.
At how big an operation did it get to be, or is it?
Yeah, so we scaled up very quickly in February 2022, and we were able to, with support, which was truly incredible because we received no government funding, but we were able to mobilize over $300 million in philanthropic donations. And a lot of that was private individuals just giving a little bit of money here and there. Because of the danger of operating in Ukraine and really that uncertainty, especially in the early days and weeks of the war, you didn't really know what was going to happen. I mean, even today we're seeing obviously just you could be, you know, walking along the streets of a city and a missile can come crashing down. So we didn't want to bring, I didn't want to bring any of my foreign staff into Ukraine unless it was absolutely necessary. So a lot of the time I was the only foreign staff that was in Ukraine, and Jose also spent quite a bit of time in Ukraine. So in turn, we activated a massive network. We had about 4,500 Ukrainians working with us. We, like I said, we raised and deployed about $350 million in the first 6 months alone, serving a couple hundred million meals. We were also getting food kits out to families. So we had warehouses, we had food suppliers, we had distributors, we had our truck drivers, we had our restaurant teams that were working and getting food out to shelters and families. And it was sort of this spider web that that we were able to start and sort of grow from there. So it became, we were the biggest humanitarian operation on the ground in Ukraine, which was extraordinarily necessary because the United Nations and certain, of course, even the U.S. government had a lot of restrictions about how they could operate, where they could go. Was it even safe to be in Ukraine? They couldn't send anybody in. So it took the World Food Program, for example, a few months to get their operation up and running. So in the very early days, we were really the only lifeline when it came to food and providing food to communities. And so it was really during that time that you know, I also really fell in love with the country and also recognized the importance of the battle that Ukraine was fighting, not just for its own survival, but really for the defense of freedom and democracy in the entire world, and certainly for Europe, and I believe very much for the United States. I mean, for a very small portion of our military budget, you know, and zero U.S. troops on the ground fighting directly, we have been able to hold off one of the biggest militaries, one of the biggest adversaries in the world. And so, you know, I think what Ukraine is doing is not just heroic, but is really essential for the future of our civilization. And really that's why I've really, you know, kind of gone all in on Ukraine the last couple of years. And that's been my major focus.
If only our Congress felt the same way as you do. I mean, because we really seem to be on the verge of, well, I mean, we're not even on the verge of it. We're now 5-6 months into an administration request that's gone unanswered, and it's taking a toll on the ground. But we'll get to that in a minute. So I'm interested in this process. You're there. You're running a big operation. I suspect World Central Kitchen is very rewarding portion of your life. And what is it that led you to say, I'm going to stick around here. I'm going to do some stuff here.
Yeah. You know, I had spent 5 years and building World Central Kitchen and even longer than that working with Jose. And, you know, we had really built the machine. The machine was and is operational even today. And as I was looking at sort of where I wanted to focus in on my efforts, World Central Kitchen very much is an emergency response organization. It's first on the ground. It's supposed to fill that gap in the earliest of days before the broader support can come in. I'm a big believer in the power, the catalytic power of philanthropy. I think private philanthropy can move very quickly. It's agile. It can be innovative way more than government funding and bureaucracies. But at the end of the day, we can't rely on philanthropy to fix the world, right? If we're waiting around for Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos to save us, I think we are in trouble. And in turn, you know, World Central Kitchen's role is in those earliest of days. And at a certain point, it needs to move on because the systems that need to come back online, whether that's after a hurricane and the electricity comes back and the water comes back and the shops reopen, you know, at a certain point, we have to wrap up our operation and move on to, unfortunately, the next disaster on the planet. So, you know, I personally just really wanted to continue to engage in Ukraine. And I felt, you know, I spending so much time, I spent a lot of those early weeks and months in eastern Ukraine, in the city of Kharkiv, in the city of Kramatorsk, seeing firsthand what the Ukrainians were facing, how they were defending themselves on all fronts. And in some ways, you know, perhaps other than some journalists and maybe more than anyone, you know, as an American citizen, I ended up spending probably more time than most anybody really getting a sense of this for the time that I spent on the ground. And so, you know, I just really felt like this is where I need to focus my energy and attention 100%. And it was around that time, one of our biggest donors at World Central Kitchen in Ukraine was a philanthropist named Howard Buffett. And Howard has done incredible work all around the world through his foundation, the Howard G. Buffett Foundation. And so I met Howard in those earliest days of 2022, and he came and saw our operation at World Central Kitchen. And he as well recognized sort of the urgency and the importance of what was happening and decided to dedicate a huge portion of his foundation support to Ukraine. And in the past 2 years, Howard personally, through his foundation, has put in, I think the numbers are over $550 million right now into Ukraine. And he's pledged even more to continue to do more in 2024 and potentially beyond. And so there was a moment where I was able to support some of Howard's efforts, and that really led me into the next phase of what I'm doing now in Ukraine, which is a bit multifaceted, working on a number of different initiatives, from infrastructure projects to supporting the Ukrainian railways launching a food train that we just put out in the east, to supporting agriculture efforts really across the board, and sort of being able to bring that experience and my time in Ukraine to bear on a wider variety of issues. And then on the side, almost accidentally, as you mentioned, we ended up launching a foundation to support the pets on the front lines after the liberation of one of the cities and regions in eastern Ukraine. We went just probably a couple of weeks after, a week or so after the Russians had withdrawn, and we saw the sheer volume of dogs and cats that were essentially homeless. These were pets that had been living with families. Maybe the families had been killed or families had to flee. And, you know, they were just kind of roaming around trying to survive. And the residents that were still there or had come back were doing their best, sometimes taking care of dozens of animals, dozens of dogs, dozens of cats, doing their best. And so we recognized this need to come in and support those animals. And it really resonated with people. You know, I think this was also a way to tell a different side of the story. We hear a lot about Ukraine. We heard a lot about Ukraine for so long and the attacks and this and that. And sometimes, unfortunately, we get a little numb to it. And so in some ways, the work with the Hachiko Foundation, which is all a volunteer-based organization, I don't get paid for it or anything. You know, it's a way to tell a different side and keep people engaged in the Ukrainian issues through cats and dogs, because everyone loves great cats and dogs, especially online.
It's true. You know, cats and dogs have played an unusually large part in the social media support effort that's going on for Ukraine. Lots of soldiers with cats have become a kind of a meme throughout this. And it's a strange comment on human beings that, you know, that we find it easier to connect to the plight of animals than other people. But we do. And also, you know, the animals are, how many I mean, like, how does that operation work? You just go into different towns and, you know, bring lots of food and water and feed them? I mean, or what?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. You know, we started, it was very kind of ad hoc in the early stages. We were operating in places where most people were not operating. There are a lot of great animal rescue support organizations in Ukraine and adoption organizations in Ukraine. The places that we were operating, there was really no presence of anybody because of the proximity to the fighting. And so, yeah, we were able to, people just started donating money, which enabled us to buy pet food and medicine. We were able to get a couple of delivery vans and a transport truck for food from warehouses. We tapped into our existing network of people that I had met working with the World Central Kitchen teams on the ground. And so we basically have different mobile teams that cover different regions. So we have a team in the Kherson region in the south. We have a team that covers Zaporizhia. We have a team that covers Donetsk, and then a team that covers the Kharkiv region. And there's a couple of things that we do. One of them is that we've set up these mobile feeding sites. So these are essentially kind of repurposed plumbing tubes that act as like gravity feeders. So we fill them up every couple of days, some every week with fresh food. And the animals that are living outside can then go to these tubes and eat. And so in a lot of, especially the frontline areas, this is really key. We also work with individuals who kind of have these informal shelters, as we call them, where they take care of dogs and cats in their homes. Sometimes in really frontline communities. I mean, they're, you know, it's really quite dangerous where they are, and it's incredible the work that they're doing. So we make sure we deliver them food and medicine for the animals that they're taking care of. And then we also do some evacuations and some vet support as well for animals that are injured. We're able to take them back. We work closely with a couple of shelters, especially in Kyiv. And we're about to launch a new program with some amazing donor support to work on spaying and neutering of animals, because that's a big piece. Because if we can go visit, for example, a grandmother who's taking care of five cats or five kittens, and we take, you know, a bunch of food, and then, you know, we come back a month later and there's 15 cats. And so, you know, we want to make sure that we're able to, provide all of the services that are necessary. So we're working on kind of a mobile vet clinic in a van that can also, so we can have veterinarians perform sterilization of the animals that we meet. So that's a component of it. But, you know, we're just basically trying to do whatever we can do. And it's all with the goodwill. And like you said, the dogs and cats have really become a central focal point for this Ukraine war, from soldiers with cats to the NAFO teams with the meme dogs. It's pretty incredible. And so we've been able to garner a lot of support for it, which we're very, very grateful for.
Yeah, that meme dog for NAFO looks like a Shiba Inu. I don't really understand the connection of that dog to Ukraine, but perhaps that's a mystery that will never be resolved. You know, the work you have done is remarkable. You and everybody who works with you deserves our gratitude and support in any way that we can. And before we end, I would like to ask you ways that people can be supportive. But one of the things that made me want to talk to you, beyond just wanting to catch up and know what you're doing, is you're kind of living, you know, most of the time we talk about Ukraine, there's a picture of Zelensky, there's a picture of politicians there, there's a high level meeting, it's the Munich Security Conference. You know, it's a kind of abstract, policy oriented, politics oriented view. But of course, the war affects people, destroys lives, tears lives apart, causes enormous suffering. And you're living right very close to the place that toll is taken. And I'm just wondering, what is your sense of the spirit of the Ukrainian people, particularly those in those regions you just described in the eastern part of Ukraine that is more affected by the war, who live with enormous hardship. Some of the those who lived in destroyed towns, much worse than that. 2 years into this war, I mean, you know, how do you gauge the morale of a country that way?
It's a great question and a great point you make, because I do think that there is a lot of attention given to these high level meetings, which of course serve a purpose. It's very important, especially as President Zelensky is going out and trying to garner support from Europe and the United States. And we understand the complexity here right now, especially in election year in the United States. I say here, I'm on my way to Kyiv right now, in the United States. But at the end of the day, sometimes those types of conversations can feel very disconnected from the reality of the day to day. And I think it's very important for us to take note of that. I've spent, and I always spend, every time I go into Ukraine, I go to the front. I spend time with friends that live in these areas. I visit friends who are in brigades that are actively fighting, so I can talk to them and see what the situation is, what's the reality versus maybe what we're hearing, because it really helps inform, I think, a real sense of where we're at. And I think where we are right now is the situation is very, very difficult. We've heard this sort of in abstract terms and abstract numbers of there's not enough artillery shells, there's not enough drones. And that's all very true. But I think also one of the things that we don't hear a lot about is there is no real regular rotation of the folks that are fighting, the soldiers that are fighting at the front. So I've had friends that spent 7 months straight at the front and then just got a new assignment and had to keep going because there simply is not enough people to rotate them out and bring in new people. And of course, this is something that the Ukrainian society is trying to deal with mobilization, which, you know, has its own challenges, unfortunately, to sort of the demoralization of the broader society. And people in the towns, I think there was a period of time where it felt like Ukraine was really moving for was repelling, was taking back ground. There was some momentum, and this has basically entirely gone away. The Ukrainians have now acknowledged, and actually, when I was just in eastern Ukraine a couple of weeks ago, it is now, you can see the defense lines and the defense fortifications now being dug. This was something that was never done earlier on in the war. The Ukrainians were pushing forward. They didn't want to dig in defense positions because it was sort of, in some ways, an acknowledgement that they were going to lose this territory. And they didn't want to acknowledge that. They didn't want to give up anything. And so now you're seeing defense lines dug. You're seeing towns that, after the liberation of Kherson in the south, there's jubilation in the streets, and we were there right after this happened. Now Kherson is a ghost town being bombarded constantly by Russian artillery. Even today, they dropped, you know, massive aerial guided bombs. They just dropped an aerial guided bomb into Kharkiv today. The attacks are stepping up dramatically. And so it's getting harder and harder for Ukrainians to kind of just go about their day-to-day lives in the eastern and southern communities that are closer to the fighting. At the same time, I do think that Ukraine has realized now, and it's very clear when I spend time there, that they cannot be entirely reliant on the West for support. And they are, as quickly as possible, trying to build up their own internal capacity to respond. And this is both on the humanitarian sense of things, so trying to make sure that communities are supported. I'm good friends with the head of the Ukrainian Postal Service, and this is, the Postal Service in Ukraine is one of these things you never hear about, we don't talk about, but in some ways is such a critical lifeline to keep Ukraine operating. It's where people go and get their pensions, right? It's how they It's how services are provided to these frontline areas. They just got a license to launch a pharmacy, so people can go to the local post office to get their medicines. It's launching a bank in a way, so they'll be able to not just, you know, sort of have cash, but we'll be able to distribute cards for people to use. So there's some really incredible innovations that are happening. On the defense side, Ukraine is very quickly building up its capacity. A friend of mine who used to run the Ukrainian railways is now in charge of the entire defense industry of Ukraine, and they're building up their own capacity. We're seeing the impact of the drones that they're able to develop. So there's a lot of work. There's a lot that needs to be done. The Ukrainians are struggling heavily. As time goes on, it gets harder and harder. And certainly watching the news and seeing the U.S. pull back on support is really painful. When I'm out in the front, they, you know, everybody asks me, what's going on over there? Why can't you see how hard we're fighting? What is going on? At the same time, they're not going to step back. They can't. There's no, you know, even sort of floating the idea of some sort of negotiation or peace negotiation is just a waste of time to even talk about, because the Ukrainians simply cannot stop. And so they're going to keep going, as tired as they are, as difficult it is, they're going to keep going. And so I think that's, we're in a really tough place right now, but I do think if we can, if the Ukrainians can get through the next 6 months, we will start to see some of the innovation and progress that they've been developing on the back end start to make its way to these frontline areas, and hopefully see a real shift in the war. We hope.
Well, no, I think we all hope. Certainly all of the tens of thousands of people who listen to this podcast hope. And so a question is, what can they do beyond hoping? We've just got a minute or two left, but I just, you know, you're in the middle of this. You see the organizations that are helping. I suppose putting pressure on your members of the House of Representatives, if it can happen, you know, makes some sense. But what about aid to Ukraine? What when your friends say to you, "What can I do to help?" What do you answer?
So I think there's two things that you can do. Of course, there's still some great organizations to support on the ground that are continuing to provide services, essential services, and aid in the most difficult areas. And I see a lot of them. Global Empowerment Mission, GEM, that's doing frontline food boxes into the hardest hit communities. I was in Avdiivka with them last year before things just got way too dangerous. We saw the Russians ended up basically obliterating the city of Avdiivka. There are incredible Ukrainian-based organizations on the ground as well, like Razom and Nova Ukraine, and many groups that you can definitely donate to, and they still need the support, because the broad sort of the initial wave of support, financial support and donations, of course, has dropped off. So I do think anything that you can do to continue to support some of these, some of this aid and some of the humanitarian work is still incredibly essential on the ground. I think the second piece that we don't talk enough about as a society is that, you know, Ukraine is not a monolith. You know, and I know it's sort of hard to understand. And even when I tell people, when I tell my family I'm headed to Ukraine, they're like, "Oh, you know, be careful." And of course, if I'm going to certain areas, but if you go to Lviv in the West, if you go to Kyiv, you know, you could actually be walking around the city and not even know there was a war going on until, of course, an air raid siren goes off. The cafes are filled with people. Business as usual is operating. People are going to work every day. The Ukrainian economy needs to continue to function, and there's a lot happening there. You're seeing GDP growth right now, which is really important for keeping things going. If the Ukrainian economy collapses, Ukraine is not going to be able to continue fighting. And so one of the things that I think, you know, we should start to think about is ways to not just look at the support to Ukraine in from the humanitarian or military sphere, but actually look at support to Ukraine and what can we do, you know, as private businesses, for, you know, supporting entrepreneurs, investing into businesses, for example, or looking at some of the technologies that are being developed there that potentially we could support, or being vocal about, you know, engaging Ukraine. I think there are a lot of people, and I'm tended to agree with this, that this war is going to go on for a very long time. And if that's the case, we're going to have to find new ways of sort of engaging in a regular sort of form, because we're not going to continue to be able to support with humanitarian packages. Even we don't even know if we're going to be able to get this one done. And so I think looking at other mechanisms, like getting private enterprises there, getting companies that could set up shop there, set up factories, do joint ventures with Ukrainian businesses, I think that's a new area that we really need to start seriously thinking about. And so as an individual basis, you know, even if you're not an investor or somebody like that, but I think starting to socialize that idea, starting to talk about it more, starting to think about ways to get involved in Ukraine, you know, and maybe even go visit, even, you know, Western Ukraine, Lviv, for example, you know, going in and visiting, getting on the ground, talking to people, seeing how, you know, potentially could engage in different types of ways. And so that's one of the things that I think we all sort of on a broader sense really need to be thinking about right now.
Yeah, really, really important point. If it's a long-term war, you can't win it with short-term solutions. And so you need organic support for Ukraine, which could mean Ukraine builds up its defense capacity, buying some of those weapons elsewhere in the world. It means, you know, Ukraine, I mean, you know, ensuring that Ukraine is able to export its agribusiness, which is, you know, been its lifeline for a long time, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's something that we all can look at. But look, you know, first of all, be safe as you go there. And secondly, you know, at some point or another in the not too distant future, I'd love to catch up again, see what you're doing, use this network. And we've got others we can pull in if there's messages that need to get out or support that needs to be drummed up, links that we should propose to people. There's a big group of sort of independent media out there that can be supportive. We'd like to be supportive. You know, I just want to say thank you. You know, you're doing remarkable work. You deserve a lot of credit. And we wish you every success in doing it.
Thank you. Thank you, David. And also, you know, I think the other thing to your point and what this network can do is, I think, continuing to be vocal. I know our Congress right now may seem completely broken, but I actually think there's quite a bit that can be helpful when we engage. I met with Speaker Pelosi, Speaker Emeritus Pelosi, last week to talk about this, and of course she remains very, very engaged in Ukraine and trying to do what she can. And she had just met with Speaker Johnson to talk through ways to move this Ukraine supplemental forward, knowing all of the challenges that are going on with the Republican Party right now. And I will say that, you know, one of the things that struck me out of that conversation was there are opportunities to engage and get involved and move the needle in ways that can be very impactful as individuals, especially individuals who listen to your podcast that have relationships and connections and can make phone calls. You know, there are some things that seem like they're stuck in the mud, but I think that there is a potential to move things forward in a lot of ways. We just have to keep some of that pressure on and keep some of those conversations happening, because you know, all parties aren't always talking to each other, if that makes sense. And so I hope that we can continue to push forward in that regard. And of course, I really appreciate all the support. And really, at the end of the day, you know, I feel like what I'm doing is a drop in the bucket compared to what the Ukrainians are doing every single day. And, you know, I really see my role as really just trying to support and uplift them and the incredible. I'm so fortunate every day to be able to work with amazing Ukrainians on the ground. And so, you know, I'm just trying to do whatever I can. So, yeah, I really appreciate it.
Well, they're not alone because of people like you. You're not alone because of all of us listening here. And hopefully we will all work together and advance this in the right direction. We'll be back in touch with you soon. Again, stay safe. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And if you're motivated, you know, do some of the things that Nate suggested you do. This is really, really important. It's not just rhetoric that, you know, keeping Ukraine alive and repelling the Russian invasion is relevant to Europe. It's relevant to the United States. It's relevant to the future of democracy. It's relevant to Taiwan. It's relevant to world peace. It's a very, very big deal. And we can't allow our short attention spans to get the best of us here now that we're just over 2 years into this expansion of this war that's actually been going on for 10 years. So we'll return to this regularly. Hopefully you will join us then. Until then, bye-bye.